Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Professor Kenneth Stowe, who is Professor Emeritus of Jewish History at the University of Haifa in Israel, and he has been a visiting professor at Yale, the University of Michigan, University of Washington, Smith College, the University of Toronto, and the Pontifical Gregorian University. He founded the journal Jewish History and served as its editor for 25 years until 2012. And the book we're going to be discussing today is a relatively recent publication, a few years, Anna and Tranquillo, Catholic Anxiety and Jewish Protest in the Age of Revolutions. He also wrote Theaters of Acculturation, the Roman Ghetto in the 16th Century, as well as Alienated Minority, the Jews of Medieval Latin Europe, as well as a number of other books and many articles as well. So thank you, Professor Stowe, for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. And I'm really delighted to talk about this book and about Italian Jewry that most people don't even know exists. They think they're Sfardim, when in fact they're Italkim, strictly Italkim. They have their own rituals, and they have a certain distinction because they are the only Jews in Europe who you really can't call immigrants. You can't call Italian Jews immigrants because they were there at the time of Julius Caesar, and in fact, probably for 100 or so years before. And in that sense, there's almost nobody in Rome who predates them. Their language, of course, is Italian. It's always been whatever the language of the day has been, first Latin and then the devolutions of Latin, but they speak Italian. And in fact, when I was working for the Book Theater of Acculturation, working on notaries. A notary in Europe is not like a notary in America, just somebody who approves your signature. It's almost a lawyer. They take down witnesses. They not only do things like being a sofer stam, but they depose witnesses. They write contracts and so on and so forth. And I once wrote an article writing in Hebrew because they were rabbis and they wrote in Hebrew, but thinking in Italian. And the classic example, and of course you have to know modern Romance languages to appreciate this, every house they rent is Habayit Shela. Now, if you know Hebrew, I mean, it's her house. But how can every house be her house? Ah, think Italian. In Italian, as in French or Spanish, the pronoun always agrees in gender with the noun itself. But wait a minute, you're saying bayit is masculine despite the ending. So shouldn't it be a bayit shelo? No, but in Italian, it's feminine. So it's casa sua and it's a bayit shelo. So you can see how Roman they were. My motto was they were as Roman as they were Jewish and as Jewish as they were Roman. And of course, today, I'm sure that some people and who are listening have been in Rome and have been in the ghetto or the area of the ghetto. There's no ghetto left. It was completely razed at the end of the 19th century because it was just a health hazard. But you go to that area where the ghetto is. It's a very, very small area. I'm trying to think of what to compare it to in the United States. It's like Battery Park or something. And you go there, and it's now become a kind of a circus with a lot of restaurants and kosher restaurants. But in any case, it's there, and it's the place of the Jews, and it used to be much more the place of the Jews. I remember going, and somebody said, "Well, this coffee is better because in Nostro, it's ours." It's very much, very significantly theirs, and a third of it is taken up by the synagogue. And I must tell you, it's a place with absolutely awful acoustics. You're in the mouth of a cone. So you can't follow, you can't hear anything that's going on. But to hear the shofar blown, and they blow it differently, it's a continuous blowing, a continuous wailing. You hear the shofar blown there, the first time I heard it on a Rosh Hashanah, I got goosebumps. And I'm not a particular, that's not my style of person, but I got goosebumps. I said, now I know how the walls of Yericho fell. It was really amazing. But what if you went to an Italian synagogue? You know, if you're an Ashkenazi and you go to a Mizrahi synagogue, even though the Sidur is close, you're going to be lost. But not in Rome. The melodies are different, but you're not going to be lost for a second. Why? Because the Ashkenazi is really a derivative of the Italian. Most people don't know that, but it is. And there is a wonderful legend that somewhere in the 10th century, Rabbi Colonimus of Lucca. Lucca is a city about halfway between Rome and the north of Italy on the coast. Rabbi Colonimus of Lucca went to Mainz. And I would ask students, well, tell me, how did he go? Lufthansa or Alitalia? And actually, I was able, by tracing the routes that people took, I was able to follow him as he went across the mountains. You have to first cross the Apennines. I think most people know that there's a chain of mountains that runs down the spine of Italy called the Apennines. And at the very end, they turn into the Alps. And he first had to cross them, then go in the Po River Valley, which is flat. And from there, he had to cross the Alps. Now, you know, wow, you just today, you just get in your car and you ride through one of the two or three tunnels that go through, and assuming that the tunnel doesn't catch fire, and they all have, they're long. The longest, the Gotthard, is something like 12 or 13 miles. It's really long and kind of frightening. I've driven them all. And in those days, you had to go over the Great St. Bernard Pass, which was 2,500 meters, or that's something like 8,000 feet. It's quite a pass. You can drive it. It's not hard. And it wasn't hard then either. You go up and you go down the rivers in Switzerland, and then up up to the Rhine River. So it's very important. And in fact, there is a saying attributed to Rabbeinu Tam, who was reflecting on what went on in southern Italy in the early century, early medieval centuries, saying, "Ki mi bari teitse Torah udvar Hashem mi Otranto." Another, Rabbeinu Tam had no idea where these places were. They're way down in the heel, practically the heel of the Italian boot. And there was a flourishing Jewish culture there. What I'm trying to say is that the Jews have been in Italy forever. They're as Italian as they could possibly be. Yet if you go to the ghetto today, therefore, when you go to eat in these restaurants, people, all Romans go because they want to eat Roman traditional food, which is Jewish food. Some people may have heard of the famous carciofo alla Giudia, the Jewish artichoke, which is an incredible art to cut the thing and to double deep fry it. I'm not going to give lessons now, but I can do it. And there are other things and so on, which make up the traditional Roman diet. A lot of fried, wonderful fried things, zucchini flowers filled with mozzarella and anchovy paste. You can get them there. They're kosher restaurants. You can, you know, with supervision. The rabbi is the chief rabbi, Riccardo De Segni, is quite strict about these things. He's a radiologist by profession. I've known him for a million years, really, since we were young, and he's an excellent, excellent person who knows what he's doing, and he's leading a very difficult community. The previous rabbi, Elia Toff, was a partisan during the war. And when he retired, it made national news. So the Jewish community in Rome is very small. We're not talking about the community of New York. We're talking about 15,000 people out of 3 million. And if you want to really be depressed on Yom Kippur, go to Rome. You know, you have 3 million people living their daily lives, munching their pizzas and God knows what, and there you are, you know, in your little angle and in your little corner doing Yom Kippur. I mean, I've done that a couple of times, so it's there. Where shall we go from here, Nathan?
Okay, so with that terrific introduction, I mean, I would ask you on that, because you're clearly very interested and you've written a lot of research on the Jews of Italy. And like I said, I've done a couple of podcasts, listeners may know. To me, they're fascinating. They're very unique and different, like you said. I mean, how did you, what was your interest in them that you decided to research them and I spend your life working on them? Is it something that just because they're so interesting? I mean, when did that start and how?
Well, you know, most things that happen in research, they just sort of happened. You didn't expect it. What happened was I started out and I wanted to write about the Jews in Roman and canon law. Why did I want to do that? Because I wasn't a great Talmud specialist. I made a mistake. I studied it. I know it's TREF. I studied at JTS. And I made a mistake. I wasn't a Talmud major, and I should have been, because I would have been able to study with Professor Weiss Halivni, Sheibadel L'Chaim. He's 96 or something. And I couldn't study with him. This was the greatest educational mistake of my life. So I couldn't begin to do dissertation on rabbinic literature. I could have, but I mean, it's not that I'm an Am Haaretz, but nonetheless, I wanted to do this. I was turned on by it, and I had learned how to read it. It's not very hard. It takes a day. It's not like learning to read Gemara, which takes your lifetime. I started to do this, and I saw it was too big a topic, and my advisor Gershon Cohen sent me to Elias Bickerman, a name that some people may know, an ancient historian at Columbia. His father was an officer in the Russian army, and since he was Jewish, this was no small feat in the Tsar's army. And Bickerman said, "Young man, get yourself a text." And I laughed at him, and I found the text the next day, which is a compendium of law on the Jews in Roman and canon law by some guy who you've never heard of called Marquardo de Susanis. But it was the standard. It was the Schlager of the day. For a couple of hundred years. And so I worked on that, and it was very interesting. But this brought me into the question of the Jews and the popes directly, and the Jews and the popes in Rome directly. Anyway, between one thing or another, I finished the dissertation and finally got to go to Israel, where I've never been able to go because there was a little thing called the Vietnam War. Going was very dicey because they might have sent you to the jungle instead of to the desert. I don't mean the jungle of Israel, of course. So I was finally able to go. And I started to meet a lot of Italians, became very, very friendly with them, a small group of Italian Jews. And somehow or other, I just wound up going to Italy and being in Italy and very close to a lot of Italians speaking, learning to speak. My Italian is not quite as fluent as my Hebrew, but it's very fluent. I mean, I'm not afraid to write letters to people in Italian, especially with a spell checker on Gmail now. I've just been there nearly every year for the last 50 years. There have been times I've spent months there and so on and so forth. So I feel very much a part of Italian Jewry in that sense. And there was a time when if I'd be in Jerusalem, I would go to the Beit Knesset Italki in Jerusalem. And if anybody ever has a chance and doesn't get to go to Italy, architect David Casuto built that little synagogue there to make it look exactly like an Italian synagogue. And the arch itself is from Conigliano, which is near Venice. And it's from the 18th century. So it's in use. It's in daily use there. So it's very good. Anyway, that's how I got into it. Then, of course, what do? You start doing research. And I started going to the Vatican. After all, it had the best library in town. You can get into the Vatican library. It's not very hard. Then just kept working and writing and finding things and so on and so forth. But I had known for a number of years of a special collection called the Notai Hebrei, the Jewish And but in Italy, you don't call somebody a Judeo. That's a no-no. The Jews say themselves, son of Judeo. That's okay, but not if anyone else calls you, you know. But they're the Hebrei, the Hebrew notaries, the Jewish notaries. They began in the 16th century. They ran for about 100 years. A father and son, Isaac Yehuda and Isaac Piatelli, which is, by the way, a very Jewish name. There are all kinds of names. If you walk down the main street in Rome, you read the names, and if you know that, oh, it's Cohen, let's Levi. It's, you know, it's the same thing. Di Castro, Di Verli, Di Segni, as in the chief rabbi. These are all very, very Jewish names, Spitzikino, and so et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I said, I'm going to do that. And I had a sabbatical and I went to Rome and I sat there copying these things. This was in 1986. Today, you just go in with your phone and you go and you photograph the whole thing and then come home and sit and read it. Not then. So that's how the Theater of Acculturation came about, in which I tried to categorize all this material. But all the time, because we're headed towards Anon Tranquillo, all the time I had in mind this book, this diary that I'm talking about. Why? This book here was the original edition of the diary. Now, I think, let me see, where are the pages? I saw it earlier. Here it is. Here's a page of the diary. And I think you can see, if you're good at reading Italian from the 18th century, then you can read this rather easily. It's not like reading Latin stuff from the 14th century, nothing light, nothing at all. If you know Italian, you can read it. And the Hebrew, too, it's a special script, but after about a week or so, you read it fluently. Anyway, this diary was published, when was it published? About 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 1989, by Yosef Baruch Sermoneta. Now, Sermoneta was one of the great scholars and great human beings and the ultimate Roman Jew. He looked like a Roman Jew, which meant short and so on and so forth. He was a magnificent scholar of literature. He revived something called Judeo-Italiano, which was an Italian Jewish language. It's written in Hebrew letters like Yiddish from the 13th century. It's really considered a language unto itself. Today, what remains is called Judeo-Romanesco, which it's Italian with all kinds of special words in it. Not too many people know too much of it anymore, but they just know a few phrases, principally for non-Jews, an Angarele and an Itzawe. But there are poets and poetry anyway. Well, this Sermonetta found this thing and he decided to publish it. I think more than he found it, it was within his family, because there's only one manuscript copy of it. It's in Jerusalem. And nobody knows who's got it. I think they do, his family. But Sermoneta, once he published this thing, once he transcribed it, there was no need for anybody to do anything else. He was such a great scholar and such a great human being, may I add. I met him when I was 26 years old, and he was welcoming and curious and very supportive. And it was that way until he died sometime in the early 90s. There's no need for anyone, as I say, to go back to the manuscript or go and look, because it's done. But there was a question of getting it out. He published it first in something called Michael, which Shlomo Simonson was publishing. And then he did it on his own with notes. And the notes are very useful, but I wanted to go further. I really, really said to myself, look, you know, there's something more that can be done with this thing, to put this young woman who's the subject of the diary into a context. And that's what I think I did in the book, which this is it. which we're talking about today. It's called Anna and Tranquillo. Now, it's the story of Anna Del Monte. Del Monte, you thought that was a pineapple company, but in fact, it's a very Roman Jewish name. It is. There are people who came from southern France, you see, because people came in to the Roman community. There were Jews, of course, in centers other than Rome, the most famous being Venice, but also Mantua and Ferrara. Those are the other well-known, but and southern Italy too, but that was removed by expulsion. The family in Hebrew, if you look in the listings in the community, they're listed as Hahar. So that's Montpellier, probably, Hahar, the mountain. And in Italian, it becomes Del Monte. And they were a reasonably well-to-do family in the ghetto, which is all the more reason to go after her, so to speak. Her brother became one of the heads of the community after her. What do we have here? That, I think, is a principal question, because when I first started to work on this book and gave it to people to read, they said, oh, well, it's a fiction. It's a biographical fiction. It was a genre which was reasonably well known at the time. It's all made up. And then, fortunately, a census emerged in Rome from 1733, and there she was as a little girl, her family, and she was, so she's a real person. Furthermore, she was not the only one to undergo what she went, underwent. In fact, it was not unusual. Let me give you the background for this. In Rome, Jews had lived freely, openly, mixed with the population, as I intimated, for centuries and centuries and centuries. There were regulations, but it was with a kind of a light hand. After all, Jews were going in and out of the papal court, doing things for the popes, and so on and so forth. There was a limit to what the popes were really going to do with the Jews. And the Jews in Rome used to even represent Jews elsewhere if there was a problem. And we have some records of this in papal letters, and we have a lot of papal letters, and I've worked on them too. I have actually, some of you may know the name of Solomon Brazel, who was the first to publish on Jews and the church. And I have in my possession from Brazel his original photographs that he made in the Vatican 80 years ago. And the quality is so high that you read them today as though they're new. Something changed in the middle of the 16th century. Largely responsible for that was a guy named Martin Luther. He broke up the church, and the church was very, very concerned about faith and faith matters, and was also concerned about maintaining itself, not only did Luther break off, another guy named the husband of Anne Boleyn, better known to you as Henry VIII, or maybe you know him as Anne Boleyn's husband, he broke off too. And he was more threatening than Luther, because Luther was just a heretic, you know, he doesn't believe right. Henry VIII said he had the full power over the church. He was the head of the church. Now, you know, popes care about two things. One, Catholicism. We'll leave that to them. The other thing is power over Catholicism. This is what the church has specialized in the last 500 years, consolidating the church. Even when they deal with Jews, you must remember it has to do with how is this better for the church? It's not do we like Jews or do we hate Jews. Too often, history of popes, this pope was good to the Jews, this pope was bad to the Jews. There is no such thing. There was only a pope who was following canon law, the law of the church and the theology of the church and the Jews, sometimes more rigidly, sometimes less rigidly, but they were always following it. Until the year 1555, when somebody who was described by his contemporaries in Italy as Don Meshuggah became, and he really was, I mean, they really thought he was crazy, named Paul IV, Gian Pietro Carafa, became Pope. And he decided that Jews should live closed off. Now, this wasn't an absolutely new idea. It had even been bandied about before in Rome 10 years earlier, and in Spain also in the last decades of Jewish existence, there Jews were kind of closed quarters. But it was never, and of course, the first ghetto itself is in Venice. After all, what's the origin of the word ghetto? Well, ghetto is the name of an island where did you put the place where Jews were going to live. It came from gettare, from throwing. They used to cast copper or something, factory. It's on the outskirts. Many of you have probably been to Venice. You know that it's far out from the center, closed in completely, walled by canals. They even walled up the windows there so the Jews wouldn't look out and others wouldn't look at Jews, because the big problem with Jews as far as the church is concerned is contact. You can corrupt something and bring impurity by contact. The church also could not expel Jews. Kings in France, England, and so they expelled Jews. But Paul IV said, no, I can't expel them because we need them. We need them for the end of days. We need them because they're just part of our law. They're guaranteed. So I will expel them into the ghetto. This is the big difference. King of England expelled them out of England. Kings of France, out of France. The popes expelled them into the ghetto. This is a very major issue, into the ghetto. And there the Jews were going to live from 1555, July of 1555, until September the 20th, 1870. Now, normally in history, you cannot pick such precise dates, but here you can. First, we know when he ordered them to live there. Most of them were living in the area anyway, of course, the same area where the synagogue is today, which, by the way, if you go on the Tiber River and the Garibaldi Bridge, about three quarters of the way over, you look to the left, you see the synagogue. You look to the right, you see St. Peter's, and they look to be the same height. And that is no accident. The synagogue was built with the great help of the city heads of Rome in 1903, and they wanted it to send a message to the Vatican because there was a war between the Vatican and the lay leaders of Rome at the time. The Pope was closed in. He was furious. He had lost his state because the Pope, the papal state, was once one third of all of Italy, the whole center of Italy, from practically Naples all the way up close to Venice, with Tuscany, the area of Florence, cut out. But the Pope was the king there, which meant he also had to run a secular state, which meant there were limits to what he could do. For instance, kosher meat. He had to let the Jews get kosher meat. But how do you get kosher meat? You need Christians. Why do you need Christians? To bring the animals and to do all kinds of other things. And so you have Jews and Christians actually working together. Of course, with all the shechita done strictly by rabbis, but other work too by Jewish apprentices. But the two had to be in absolute cooperation. Anyway, the Pope has these three Jews. He has to deal with them, and he closes them in the ghetto. So they're closed from 1555 until the papal state falls on September the 20th, 1870. And one of the things that they wanted to do was, we'll make the Jews equal to everybody else. No more religious law. And that is a sign of emancipation. In fact, emancipation is something that people talk about. Well, the Jews gradually got rights. It's not true. The Jews did gradually get privileges, they moved more freely. I'm talking about 18th century Europe now, leading up to the French Revolution, not the American colonies for a second, but the French Revolution. But for all that the Jews get more and more privileges, there's a problem, because the legal system is based on religious law. It was something called jus commune. Jus commune translates as common law. It's a derivative of ancient Roman law. Ancient Roman law was already Christianized by the 6th century. It was only when Napoleon in 1804 threw out this jus commune and installed in its place the French civil code, le code civil, that was when Jews could become emancipated. In the United States, it was de facto, that is, nobody ever had religious law as the law. Well, they did, actually, in Massachusetts, Connecticut. But that broke down The big one who broke it down was James Madison, by the way. He wrote a letter to Mordecai Emanuel Noah saying, if we have religious law and religious discrimination, all our civil liberties will go. But in the United States, they're very, very clear that that being a citizen, George Washington writes to the Jews of Rhode Island and he says to them, you know, he says the famous lines, we give to bigotry no quarter. Everybody cites this letter. But in fact, what he said is, you're good citizens, you're good people, you obey the law, and people who obey the law are good citizens. That was his qualification for a citizen, somebody who obeyed the law. They didn't have immigration problems in those days. That's a different world. But the Jews in the Roman ghetto are living strictly under canon law, and it becomes very, very difficult and very, very precise. And one of the things, and that's where we're getting directly to this book, this is all background, but if they don't give it to you, you will not understand what's going on in this book. One of the things is that there were cases of people who offered, that's a technical word, not to make, you know, I offer you a cup of tea or something like that. There are people who offered other people to the House of Congress. Who offered other people? Well, it could be if a father converted, and there were, and we know the names of all the people who converted. If a father converted, say, I offer my children, they would be quickly taken and baptized. No ifs, no ands, no buts. He couldn't offer his wife, but of course, what wife is going to refuse? She has three children, and she sees them taken from her, and she's not allowed to ever to see them again. She's going to convert too. So it's a chain. The other thing was a young man converts, and that's specifically the case here, Shaul or Samuel Cohen, and he offers Ana del Monte. Now, we are not talking about some rich duke or something of a Jew who converts and all. We're talking about a Luftmensch, and the ghetto has had plenty of them. We're talking about somebody who had no prospects, no nothing. She's from a very good family. And he goes and he says, she's my fiance. Now, he clearly didn't say that he may have said Anachnu Arusim. He didn't say Anachnu Mekudashim. If they'd been Mekudashim, she was finished. If there was a Tabat, all gone. But Erusin, as Chaim Soloveitchik himself once told me, has no real halachic stand. It's sort of a loose kind of thing, and she could play. So they take her into the House of Converts, and they can keep her for 12 days. Most people got taken in. They were kept for a quarantine. If you hear quarantine, you hear 40, quarenta. Quarantine, by the way, the 40 days comes from Venice. This is apropos of today, because when there was a plague and ships would arrive with foreign sailors, they kept them for a quarantine for 40 days in the ships. And that's the origin of the term quarantine. Anyway, they could keep her only for 12 days. The question was, would she convert? As I say, she was hardly the only one ever taken in. We have a lot, excuse me, of examples. In the early 18th century, we have 23 examples of the heads of the community being told to produce somebody for the House of Congress. And this was really a very, very rough, very hard thing for them to do, but they had to do it. They had no choice, or they would have been fined, they would have been imprisoned. And in fact, nobody wanted to be a head of the community in the 18th century, largely for this reason. The community was broke, by the way. It had no money. It couldn't afford anything. Even the meat they were eating was bufala. What is bufala? Bufala is an ox-like character. Now, today, bufala are very important because they produce the milk that makes the mozzarella with a special taste, the stuff that you really like. And it can be had kosher, by the way, with a hechsher. But in any case, that's all they could eat. No one else wanted to eat it. It's not rare. And in fact, Attilio Milano, who was the really important historian of The Ghetto, his book, unfortunately, The Ghetto of Rome from 1964, it's never been translated, probably never will be. It's a pity because it's really a wonderful book, way, way ahead of its time. And of course, that's because the people in the historical profession don't want to translate it, since he made his living manufacturing stocks in Hod HaSharon in Israel. But he wrote all kinds of things. He spent probably his brother was running the business and he was writing and working in the archives. Milano says that about a quarter of the people got out who were taken in there, which seems to me rather a reasonable thing. Well, this Anna was taken in, she says, the diary says, when she was 17 or 18 years old. Well, that would bring us to about 1749, 1750. We know that she was dead by 1779 from something that's said in the diary itself. So she didn't live a long life, but of course, this is the 18th century, and to live a life of 45 years was not exceptional. You know, people... we all think of life expectancy today as 85 years or something like that. But maybe some of you remember that, that no earlier than 30 or 40 years ago, life expectancy was 60 or something like that. So to live 45 years in that period, it's a normal life. But in any case, she says she left some notes. We don't know exactly what she left because, as I said, there is only one copy of this diary that's in existence, which Sermonetta transcribed. So she writes this diary, and her brother, whose name is Tranquillo, which would be in Hebrew, it's Menucha, he decides to make it public. Now, what made it public? What exactly did he mean by making it public? He didn't publish it because we'd have more than one copy. This is the publishing of late 18th century. It's no big deal. Anybody can make a book, publish a book, sell it in a couple of thousand copies, and then it floats around. No. It was too dangerous because it says terrible things about the church. She, in the diary, says awful, awful things. I suppose I should have gone through it and picked up a couple of pieces. Nothing. Do you remember anything in particular? Because you just reread it. She says your religion is nothing. You do this, you do that, and so on and so forth. Well, Tranquillo worked on it, maybe with someone else, and they pass it around. There are lots of reasons why I think that he published it. This has to be guessed at. For one thing, he does it in 1793. Now, when we write history, we tend sometimes 1793 Italy, we think of 1793 Italy. But 1793 means the American Constitution has been ratified already since 1786. The French Revolution has already granted the Jews equality, theoretical equality in citizenship. The Jews in Austria are getting a better deal than they used to have, to say the least. And the Jews in Tuscany, that's right on the border of the Papal State. By the way, if you ever go, and there's a town on the border in Tuscany called Pitigliano. There are no Jews there. You get kosher wine comes from there, by the way. They've maintained all the institutions. It used to be a place where Jews would go and live, and then they'd go into the Papal State and work and lend money and go back to Pitigliano. It's hard to get to, but it's worth it. I've been with a tour group up there, and they said it was the height of the trip, and the trip was Jewish anyway. Where were we here? I lost my track.
The in Tuscany, what was going on in Tuscany?
What was going on in Tuscany? Yes, in Tuscany too, Jews were becoming much more free, and particularly in the city of Livorno, Leghorn, there was never a ghetto there. Because there were Sfardim who had been invited. They were terribly important. There is a wonderful book. It's a little thick by a Francesca Trivolato called The Familiarity of Strangers, which is about these people, the Ergas and Silvera family. family, names which may register to you if you've been in Israel, certainly. I have a friend, the Rome Miriam Simbera, and it traces these people, and they're really special. She's a very important friend of mine, but also an incredibly great scholar. And she wrote this book, which I urge everyone to try at least to read part of it. All of it you won't be able to because it gets theoretical, but it's a wonderful book. And she, by the way, Nachi, said she wouldn't mind being asked to participate. She's at the Institute for Advanced Study, only that. They know what's going on. And they're saying, what is this? In Rome, life is getting tougher and tougher. And in 1775, the Pope Pius VI he just went over the deep edge. He said, no, Christians can't come in to remove refuse from the ghetto. What are you going to do? The water supply. The Jews have been very particular. I have records of them repairing the drains and building pipes and all kinds of things. Rome, interestingly, had sewage, public sewage, 200 or 300 years before the rest of Europe, already from the 16th century. Well, he won't let them do that. He won't let laundry women come in to take the clothes out. There wasn't enough water in the ghetto to wash clothes. And the Jews write and they say, wait a minute, what are you doing here? We were going to have a plague that's going to go out of the ghetto into the whole city. More than that, there's something really weird. In the Jus Commune, the Jews are denominated citizens. And the common legal opinion, and I write about this in this book, the common legal opinion of all the great lawyers was the Jews are entitled to absolutely equal rights in anything that doesn't have to do with religion. Now, obviously, there's a lot of room there, anything that has to do with religion. But if the Jew went to civil court, if you were a Christian and you had stolen money from me and I went to court, you would be condemned. If you had tricked me in a land deal or something or a commercial deal, I could go to court and I could get Christian lawyer. One of the things I wanted to do over much time and haven't been able to do because it just don't seem to be records, is to see if I can identify lawyers, Christian lawyers who work for Jews, to see if I could follow them and their careers and anything we could learn. But I just have not been successful in doing that. That's too bad. But it would be fascinating to see. There was one in particular who features in this book, a Carlo Luti, who tells the Pope when the Pope comes up with some ID, he says to the Pope, listen, you're this is just papal arrogance, which is rather amazing. It has to do with rules about when you could take someone into the house of converts and when you couldn't. And it's a classic legal text because he builds all kinds of things from the past. And by putting them together, he creates something entirely new. Anyone who knows law knows that that's a classic work because, it's all here. We had it in the past. There's nothing new here. And one of the things that's new, actually, by osmosis is, who can offer somebody? Originally it had to be a parent or a husband or somebody like that. But bit by bit, and by this time, they're even allowing uncles and cousins. And another legal scholar says, if we keep up with this, we'll even allow in-laws to offer people. And it's very, very threatening. The most threatening thing of all, I would say, was the question of women who would be pregnant and their fetus would be offered. Those women would be dragged immediately into the house of converts and held there till the child was born and the child would be immediately baptized. Why did they drag them in? Well, there's a legend that goes back to the 5th century. It's called the Jew of Bourges, and you can find it everywhere. The question of why the women were the Jew of Bourges. The Jew of Bourges is that a young man comes to his father, a Jewish man, and says, I want to convert, or I took the Eucharist. And the father is so angry that he throws the son into a furnace. The son, of course, is saved by the Virgin. And this legend goes all over Europe. Somebody named Gonzalo de Berceo, who was in a monastery, somewhere in the middle of the wilds of Rioja in Spain. I mean, it makes Jenemek Velk look like New York. And I've been there. It's really, even he's got it in his Praise of the Virgin. This thing goes on. And if you think about it, the kid is obviously in the furnace. He's really a communion wafer. So the Jews attack and burn communion wafers. The Jews attack Christianity. The Jews contaminate Christianity. This is the constant theme in the Middle Ages. And, you know, it really isn't that new with racial anti-Semitism either, is it? It's a laicization of that. So it goes many different directions, but still it's linked. Anyway, the story reaches its climax with a boy called Shimon Abeles in Prague at the end of the 16th century. He's about to convert and there's a fire and he dies or something like that. Or they just accuse the father of killing the kid and so on and so forth. It's the ultimate development. So they're afraid the Jewish mothers, who if they're taken, will either kill the child when it's born or they will abort beforehand. And I mentioned abortion before, and you have to know that abortion, and you think that it's from time immemorial in the Catholic Church, and actually it isn't. It's really only from about this time, because you have legal opinions that it's the wrong thing to do, but it's not a mortal sin until around this time. Why? Because the old medieval opinion was that the fetus is like an apple hanging from a tree. And if it's like an apple hanging from the tree, it's not independent. It's part of the mother. Now, they're not interested in life in the biological sense. They're interested in soul. If it's an apple hanging from the tree, you can't baptize it because that's like by baptizing the mother twice, and you can't baptize anybody twice. It's an insult to the sacrament. In the 18th century, the so-called science develops then they say the fetus is independent, therefore it can be baptized, and this had tremendous effects. I won't go into them because they're rather gruesome about cesarean sections. Cesarean section in the 16th century, you can imagine what that meant. They did not have antibiotics, did they? They're afraid that Jewish women will actually do these things, and they drag them in. So all these things build up together, and it's just too much pressure on this Tranquillo. And he also has a specific case of somebody who is married and is offered, and he somehow saves her. And he was also a mohel. And he, when the child is born, they got the baby, the woman back, and he was the mohel for this child. And I think that's the thing that kicked him to kind of make this thing public. People challenged him and said, well, you can't prove anything else, but just look at the whole thing altogether. Now let's look at the dyer itself. I've been building up. I'm not saying, well, let's get to the meat, but I want you to, you know, what's going on. One other little thing that's very important to know. A girl who was taken in to the house of converts like Anna, even if she got out, she is spoiled merchandise. Nobody will marry her. It's too dangerous. She could have promised the children in order to get out. She could have, they could, on the slightest pretext, she could say in public, I believe in God. They say, but God is the Trinity. Drag her in and baptize her again. And so nobody, so we know this. We know that the lawyers were complaining that they said that people shouldn't be taken to the house of converts. They should be taken privately to find out what they want. And if they say no, let them out. Well, the diary. The diary itself is the 12 days that she's there. And I would like to just read for you the first page of this thing, because it will give you an idea of what's going on. She goes on, without warning, on the 20th of April, 1749, at the end of the Passover festival, Sunday at about 17 hours, that's the way they counted then, things were different, I was kidnapped and taken away by force, thanks to a false denunciation made against my family by a scoundrel. The Hebrew is Rasha. All right, they write Rasha. Sometimes they write Hebrew words into the diary. I was totally innocent, but he tricked the vice regent, that's the head of Rome for all technical purposes, into issuing an order that led straight away to the Bargello, the sheriff and his men bursting into my home and seizing me. They sandwiched me in between them with their pistols drawn. They did not even give me the courtesy or the time to change my clothing or to say a word to my mother and father, as though I were a whore, slapping everybody around and paying no attention to people's rank or even their state of health. They snapped me up like a buffoon in such haste that I still had on my apron. When my father tried to speak to me, they shoved a pistol into his face. Only God saved his life. I was pushed into a carriage next to the sheriff and taken with the speed of the wind to the Casa de Catecumeni, the House of Converts. When we arrived at the house, I was put into the hands of the prioress, who took me by the hand. She led me into a small room, which had a small bed for one person, a little table with a drawer for food, which could be locked. I was left alone until the prioress appeared for the first time to visit me, telling me to pray to God that I be illuminated to convert and to be contrite. I responded boldly. Now, this is the theme of the diary. It comes on every day that she's there. I responded boldly and with pluck that I had already been illuminated. They mean illumination to Catholicism. She means as a Jew. And that I had no intention of being deceived to desert the religion into which I was born. Each time she approached me with the same priest, I told her that I was committed to the faithful, to his divine majesty, praying that he give me the strength and grace to return to the arms of my parents and to their belief, and that I would be happy should I be considered worthy in the true light of our holy Sabbath. Well, it goes on like that each day. Then they come to her and they ask her, what do you want for dinner? And she tells them two eggs. One she's going to put away so she can keep count of the days. But think a minute. Why would she ask for two eggs? Why doesn't she ask for, some salad? Why doesn't she ask? Well, she's certainly not going to ask for meat. Why doesn't she ask for because the egg, of course, is kosher. It's and this is part of the thing. We have to be whole. We have to be fast. And it goes on every day like this. And more and more and more pressure. And she keeps reiterating, I'm not going to give in. I'm not going to move. And no matter what they do to her, and they do, there is a terrible person who comes in, a priest who's a convert. Now, the converts, once you become a convert, it's better to attack the Jews. Once you become a convert, you have to be, really rigorous so that you can keep in good graces and get a job from this. That's exactly what they're doing. But this guy is really crazy. And at one point he comes in and he dances around her and he's got a chain and he's waving it over her head and they're throwing their 10 priests in the room with her. Can you imagine this? Think of this poor 18-year-old girl surrounded by 10 priests and they're throwing water all over her. And meanwhile, the more they throw the water, the more what happens when you throw water on somebody's clothing, the more the clothing clings. So the more she feels naked and the more she feels like she's being ravished. It's an emotional rape, essentially, that's going on here. But she holds up. She says, and this is a refrain of the book, they're trying rubare l'anima, to steal my soul. Now, to steal my soul, somebody tried to translate this to means to steal my free will. Now, free will, it can be squashed, but you can't steal somebody's free will. It's just part of their innate structure. What it means, rubare l'anima, is much more. It means to steal my identity. An Italian today would use that phrase in the sense that they're trying to take away my identity, who I am. I am Jewish through and through. I belong in the ghetto. I want to go to my parents. I want to live with my home. I want to observe the Shabbat. She keeps going on with all of these things. And the prioress, who is also the prioress and the head of the woman's head of the monastery, she says, but I loved you and I'm so disappointed. And she gets so angry. It, it, you have to actually read it to experience it. The drama builds and builds and builds. And that's why I'm sure that it was structured by the brother. And ultimately, this vice regent calls her and says, you know, you're important. It's your last chance, but I'll let you go. And she says, no, I'm going home. And then, I know I've been brief on the diary, but it's really, you just have to read it and read it. I hope I enticed you with the background of it to see it, because each day it gets more and more. They come in more. They bring in new priests. They pour the water. They put pressure on her. Then she dreams at night of her grandfather, who she says, I dream of him with this siman. Siman. Is actually the hat which Jews were forced to wear in the ghetto. But what Jews do with these things is they make these things. Oh well, they're part of our costume. That's wonderful. This is our identification badge. They steal the thunder from it. In the Middle Ages, they asked that when they first start with the badge, there are only a couple of references to it. One of them is amazingly, what's the question they ask? Well, if it's sewed on, can you wear it on Shabbat? Once they've made it a halachic category that's acceptable, then it's not so fearsome, is it? What you know is not fearful. So that's what they did with this hat. And she dreams of him, and she sees birds in the morning, and she knows that she's going to make it through. And at the end, they take her home, and there's an incredible scene of people coming in and out of the rooms, and then they go to the Beit HaKnesset the next Shabbat. And of course, you know, the women are sitting separately and differently. They may even have been in a room off to the side, but they were still there. There were even women prayer leaders, by the way. And we know the name of one, at least. It's great festivity. And then they come, they bring her dresses and things like this. And he said, that's the end of the diary. Why does it end that way? They're trying to pretend that it really wasn't so bad. That's false. It's fictitious. I'm sure it is. It's not the way it ended was the way I said before. She was just left broken, probably broken in spirit as well as unmarriageable and so on and so forth. And that's this sad diary. I read the diary as the protest of Tranquillo against the situation of the Jews. How absurd it is that in 1793 in Italy, when the Jews all over that we know are moving out of the ghetto, they're being emancipated, they're attaining equality. And believe me, they know, they, and it's not just what I think. They were writing letters to Jews in all the towns and all the places and receiving back information from them and their charters and so on and so forth. They knew absolutely not. And also the ghetto isn't a prison. Jews left. They did business elsewhere. They went in, they went out. They knew very well what was going on. So how absurd what's going on in Rome. And the absurdity was sensed by people outside, and the other chapters in the book talk about how the legal structure was such that Jews are citizens on the one side and yet completely restrained on the other, which makes it very clear, and that's the importance of this book for the study of the history of emancipation, which make it very clear that until the legal system per se is completely revised, until that happens, which was something that was desired throughout Europe and having nothing to do with Jews, because they just wanted to get rid of this kind of structure of the state. They wanted to make the state secular. Until that happens, then, you know, nothing is going to move for the Jews in emancipation. And of course, it doesn't happen until 1870, which is when the Jews rush out of the ghetto. And then in 1938, of course, we have the racial laws, where they're effectively put into a ghetto again, not with walls, but in terms of the laws and in terms of what was going on. Fortunately, more Roman Jews, relatively speaking, survived the Shoah than elsewhere, largely because they were warned ahead of time. A lot of them just simply ran into Naples. Some in the north got out. They crossed the Alps into Switzerland, which wasn't such an easy thing because the Swiss sent people back. But still, of the Roman population, you had about 1,600 or 1,700 people who were taken away and who died ultimately in Auschwitz. And it was literally beneath the Pope's window. And the big thing is that during all this time that the Jews are in the ghetto and whatever, there were limits to papal action. Even this terrible Pius VI eventually had to relent on so much of what he wanted to do. But they had to protect the Jews. They had to preserve them. They would always speak out if somebody was going to attack the Jews physically. I know it's not much, but at least you know they're not going to let you be killed. This time, Pius XII did not speak out. And to me, that was, you know, that's when it broke everything. The Jews always knew that the Pope would speak out. This other book that I mentioned earlier, Levi's Vindication, the point of the author is the Pope will protect us. The Pope may want to burn our books, some of them anyway, but at least he won't let anybody come and kill us. He won't let anybody convert us by force. He says to the Pope, you know, you are the king of the nations, and it's your right to tell us whether we have to convert or not. He doesn't want that, of course, but he's saying you have the power over us. We trust you. And he cites papal law, actually, on this. But here, Pius XII did not. And that was the big difference. He didn't. Now, there were Jews saved all over in Rome. There's, interestingly, this house of converts is next to a church, Madonna dei Monti, and there's a cupola. But, you know, the inside of the cupola is not the outside of the cupola. There's a huge airspace in between. And they had Jews hiding up in that cupola in the church. There were all kinds of things that were going on like that. But today, incidentally, they're putting little markers, bronze markers, on the pavement outside of houses where Jews were taken in the Shoah. It's rather moving. So it's a chapter in the history of this extraordinary community, which still retains very much its identity and very much its sense. It's strengthening, it's weakening, it suffers from intermarriage like all Jewish communities do. But it will hold on and it will go on. But this was an amazing episode, and I thank you for giving me the chance to talk about it.
Thank you for coming on and talking about it. I want to add, before we finish the recording, I want to add that, like you mentioned about the diary, it's pretty fascinating. The diary is pretty small. I mentioned the book, it's like 30 pages with explanatory notes. And then there's like you said, there's a lot of other discussion about it. You have other chapters in the book. The diary, like I said, it's very gripping. It goes through the whole thing. There's every day who comes in. There's 12 days. And then they're just trying to get her to say yes, because yes, they're going to take it and they're going to grab it. And oh, yes, you agreed to convert. And then, like you said, you portrayed the whole scene when she gets home. And then there's more in there. Like I said, she has the dream with the grandfather. And then she wakes up and she says to Hillam, and she, you know, and like you said, the whole time she's talking about it, she's davening Ma'ariv, it's Shabbos. It's just a really fascinating diary to read about what happened. I will include the link to the book in the show's notes. Also, I mentioned this to you before we started recording that, I don't think it's that expensive new to begin with, and definitely it can be gotten used for pretty cheap if anybody wants to read it. Yeah. Like, it's a fascinating read. You can get it used.
No, everybody has to buy it new, because maybe I'll finally get to pay off my debt to Yale or something. I don't...
Yeah, well, they can buy it new or they can buy it used. But yeah, everybody...
You buy it used, yeah.
It's a fascinating read. So just as we wind down here, I would ask you, are there any other, you mentioned a couple of the books throughout, other books on the topic or on the Roman ghetto that you would mention? And also, finally, are there any other, what are you, you know, like I mentioned a couple of your books, there's other ones that I didn't mention that you wrote as well. Are there any other, is there any new future project that you're working on now?
Well, I want to urge everybody to read Theater of Acculturation too. It's a book which has been used in a lot of college courses, especially at Princeton. Sociologists like it very much. They don't know whether it's history or sociology. In fact, it mystifies them that I could have both, and I'm not a sociologist by any stretch of the imagination. And it's really fascinating about Jewish life in Rome. And it's a book which has done exceedingly well, so it's worth talking about. What I'm working on now, as I indicate, well, I've mentioned some other books. as I said, the best book is in Italian, so you'll have to learn Italian to read it, Milano's book. There's a very interesting book, Life with the Evil Pope, by Martina Mampieri, M-A-M-P-I-E-R-I. It came out of Brill, and it's the story of somebody who was arrested and taken to the court of the Inquisition in Rome. It wasn't because he was heretical or anything like that. A Binyamin ben El Natan of a city outside of Rome. It's a fascinating, she brings his whole report. It's really a lovely piece of work. It's only by a young scholar, and it's out only a year. There's David Sorkin's book on the Enlightenment, which I think is a very good introduction, S-O-R-K-I-N. Then there is Collection of Essays, People Want to Get More Technical, by David Ruderman, which is, there's one of mine in there. And then there are the books of Robert Ruvain Bonfil, whose Italian is much better than mine. Actually, his mother language is Greek, and he speaks Portuguese with his wife because she's from Brazil. But his mother was a Greek speaker. His great book is the book on on the rabbis of Italy. And that is really, if you're interested in rabbinic history, you simply must read that book. It is a truly important book. And then he has another book on Jewish life in Renaissance Italy, which is pretty easy to read through. And that's Jews all over Italy. Bonfil is an exciting historian. He's actually a mathematician, and he writes history like a mathematician or a physicist. Everything is structured, but it's interesting. And then before Ariel, if you want to get upset, no, it's not in English, fortunately, Ariel Toaff's Passovers of Blood, which he effectively tries to get you to believe that blood libels are real. And it's a shanda and a cherpa. I've written at length about why it is. And it's, but if you want to, you know, if you want to have indigestion, it's a good book. But again, I don't think it's been translated. No one would get near it. And then for Venice, the work of Ben Ravid and another scholar, an art historian, Donna Katz, spelled like cats, they are Ravid is R-A-V-I-D, Ravid in Hebrew. He's an American, Bostonian doc. Those are the really good things that I think are available now. Parallel, and of course, David Kurtzer's The Kidnapping of Edgardo Mortara, for which I'm eternally angry because I would have called this The Kidnapping of Anna Del Monte, but I couldn't. So there, it's a good book. It's written nicely. There's some of the historical argument is a little equivocal, but still, it's a good book. You want to enjoy reading it.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned in the beginning of Martina Mampieri. So I have interviewed her. Many listeners probably will listen to that interview. We discussed her book, which is really interesting, but just published by Brill, so it's about $200. But
I said to her, why in the hell? I mean, she's a young scholar and she's very good. And of course, she's not Jewish, but she's learned Hebrew very well. So she's trying to work on Yeshaya Zana, who was absolutely fascinating character. Who published it in Hebrew along with all kinds of documentation, really important documentation. Mi Pius Harvi'i mi Paulus Harvi'i ad Pius Achamishi.
So there was that, and then you mentioned there's a couple of other books as well. So either I'll put them in the post, or anybody wants, they could email me. And then finally, before we finish up, you were mentioned what you're working on currently.
Yeah, I'm working on meat. As I said, the question of the provision and slaughter of meat in the Roman ghetto, which is truly amazing. I think in some ways it shows enormous light on what Jews could accomplish. How are they going to get themselves meat? People in cities ate meat in those days, believe it or not. I have never been able to figure out exactly how much. You can't figure out how in Rome people cut meat anyway. I guarantee anybody here goes to Rome and looks into a butcher shop, you'll never know what you're looking at. It's totally unlike anything that you have here. But the question was, how would they work with Christians? How did they work with canon law? How did they get involved with each other? How scandalous were they? Of course, it's kosher meat, and it's all of these issues come together, and also a certain crisis that occurred when they prohibited Jews, because what they would do, from the best of my knowledge, is they would slaughter the animal, the shochet, of course, and they cut it into four parts. One of the hindquarters they actually did nikur on, which is amazing. They actually did it. And then the other one they would sell to Christians, which was cheaper meat, but Christian butchers would take it and sell it. And then there was the inside. And the Romans have a whole litany of things they do with the innards, which are a quarter of the meat. So it's all this kind of stuff. And it's rather fascinating. And I still have a few questions to answer. One of them being what happened when the racial laws came in. Was the old regime somehow restored and Jews couldn't sell their meat? Because the racial laws are also linked with the Pope's agreement of 1929 with Mussolini. So I think I'm going to see if I can learn something about that. I don't think I will. I know that Ricardo has written a good, wonderful article on it, that is Ricardo De Seni, but not is not strictly he on defense of kashrut, because there is a problem, as we all know, in Europe about kosher meats, about doing shechita. All these things. Some guy gets on the BBC and says, I don't want to eat meat that's been dedicated or blessed by another god. Literally.
Very well. Okay. Thank you very much for joining me, Professor. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for inviting me.